Ekatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, some topics feel absolutely essential for understanding how the world works, but they often seem locked away behind really complex math. Microeconomics is definitely one of those.
It really is. And our goal today, our mission, is to sort of break down that barrier. We're going to dig into the work of Avinash Dixit, blending his, well, profound theoretical insights with his amazing ability to make these ideas practical.
Right.
We want to understand microeconomics not as, you know, a bunch of equations, but as a powerful, intuitive, almost a way of thinking that applies to pretty much every strategic choice you face.
Exactly. I mean, we all face economic choices constantly. How we manage our time, where we decide to shop, whether we save or spend right now. Dixit really gives us the toolkit to analyze those choices properly.
And fundamentally, microeconomics is all about scarcity. That's the starting point. We have limited resources, but, well, basically unlimited wants. So the core question becomes, how do individuals like consumers or companies, even governments, make the best possible decisions when faced with that scarcity and often uncertainty?
And what happens when all those choices add up?
Precisely. And what are the collective consequences? It's really a structured way to study incentives and see how they play out in society. Our guide through this, Avinash Dixit, is genuinely one of the most distinguished economists of the last 50 years or so. He's professor emeritus at Princeton University, and anyone who studied game theory or international trade knows his name. His work is foundational.
Yeah, what's so amazing about Dixit, I think, is his ability to work at the absolute highest level of abstract theory, but at the same time be this master communicator.
Mm-hmm.
He can translate really complex mathematical logic into, you know, accessible decision-making intuition.
That's a great way to put it.
He's like the bridge between the academic whiteboard and the boardroom, or even just everyday life.
And his perspective is particularly vital today because he puts such a strong emphasis on strategic interaction. You know, older economic models sometimes treated markets like these anonymous forces. But Dixit, really leaning on his game theory background, shows us that most of the interesting stuff happens when your best move depends entirely on what you expect others to do.
So it's not just about abstract forces, it's about anticipating others.
Exactly. He gives you that rigorous foundation, sure, but his focus always seems to be on the application. How do you actually deal with market failures or strategic competitors or situations where one person knows more than the other? It's economic thinking designed for a messy, interconnected world.
Okay, so let's talk about the central argument in his work. What's the big picture?
Well, Dixit presents microeconomics as having this kind of dual purpose. On one hand, it's a descriptive tool. It helps us understand how markets actually work, you know, the mechanics of it. Right, but it's also a normative framework. It gives us tools to evaluate whether those market outcomes are good in some sense. Are they efficient? Are they achieving what economists call Pareto efficiency?
Pareto efficiency. That's the idea where you can't make anyone better off without making someone else worse off, right?
Precisely. It's a benchmark for evaluating outcomes. So a big question microeconomics tackles is how these rational actors navigate trade-offs under all these constraints.
And the journey he takes us on, it seems very logical. It starts with the real basics, like individual preferences, what you want, and constraints, what limits you, and then it carefully builds up the whole structure. It doesn't shy away from the tricky stuff either, like game theory or asymmetric information. And crucially, market failures.
Absolutely. The scope is really comprehensive. It covers consumer behavior, how firms make decisions, and then it walks through all the different kinds of market structures from the textbook ideal of perfect competition right through to oligopolies, where just a few big players dominate and strategy is everything.
And he keeps balancing the theory with practical relevance.
Always. Throughout, Dixit makes sure the theoretical rigor is there to support practical analysis, whether you're thinking about public policy or, you know, business strategy.
All right, let's start unpacking the core toolkit then. If the fundamental problem is scarcity, dealing with limited resources, where do we begin?
The very first principle, and maybe the most important concept in all of microeconomics, is understanding opportunity cost.
Ah, yes, what you give up.
Exactly. The true cost of doing anything isn't just the money you spend or the time you invest. It's the value of the next best alternative that you had to forego, that you had to give up to take that action.
So, like, if you decide to spend Saturday afternoon watching a football game, the opportunity cost isn't zero. It's maybe the studying you could have done or the extra work you could have put in or time with family.
Right.
Whatever your next best alternative was.
Precisely. And rationality in economic terms means acknowledging that trade-off, even if it doesn't involve money directly. It forces you to be clear about what you're sacrificing.
Okay, so opportunity cost frames the choice. How do we actually make the choice?
That brings us to the absolute cornerstone of rational decision-making, marginal analysis. Most decisions we make aren't these huge all-or-nothing choices. They're incremental. Should I hire one more person? Should I study for one more hour? Should I eat one more slice of pizza?
Right, it's about the edge, the margin.
Exactly. Dixit really emphasizes that rational decisions are almost always made at the margin. You compare the marginal benefit, the extra gain you get from that one additional unit, against the marginal cost, the extra expense or effort of that one additional unit.
And if the extra benefit is bigger than the extra cost, you do it.
You do it. If not, you don't. It's this simple, disciplined comparison that allows both firms and individuals to optimize, to make the best choice given their circumstances. It sounds simple, but applying it consistently is incredibly powerful.
Okay, so scarcity forces the choice, opportunity cost defines the trade-off, and marginal analysis guides the decision. Now, who are the main actors making these choices in the economy?
Well, we typically start with the consumer. Their goal, generally, is to maximize their satisfaction, or what economists call utility, given the limitations of their budget constraint.
They want the most happiness for their buck, basically.
Pretty much. And a key idea here is the law of diminishing marginal utility. That first scoop of ice cream is amazing, the second is good, the third, maybe not so much. Each additional unit gives you less extra satisfaction. That's fundamentally why the demand curve slopes downward as the price falls. You're willing to buy more, but only up to a point.
Makes sense. And on the other side of the market,
you have the producer, the firm. Their main goal is typically maximizing profit. They figure out the best amount to produce by finding the point where the marginal revenue, the extra income from selling one more unit, exactly equals the marginal cost of producing that unit.
The MRMC rule.
That's the one. That logic determines how much they're willing to supply at different prices, which gives us the supply curve.
So you've got consumers demanding goods based on utility and price, and producers supplying goods based on cost and price.
And when you bring those millions, billions of individual decisions together in a market, you get market equilibrium. That's the point where the supply and demand curves cross. It's where the quantity consumers want to buy at a certain price matches the quantity producers want to sell at that price.
The invisible hand coordinating everything.
In theory, yes. It's a pretty amazing concept how prices can coordinate all this activity without any central planner telling people what to do. It matches needs with capabilities, ideally.
Okay, but before we move on from this sort of ideal market picture, we need to touch on elasticity, right? That seems crucial for anyone in business.
Oh, absolutely critical. Elasticity is all about sensitivity. It measures how much the quantity demanded of a good changes when its price changes.
So some things people buy no matter the price. Others, they drop immediately if the price goes up.
Exactly. Think about something like essential medication, maybe insulin. If the price goes up, people still desperately need it, so demand doesn't change much. That's inelastic demand. Now think about, say, a specific brand of soda. If its price doubles, what do?
I'd buy a different brand or just drink water. Easy switch.
Right. Demand drops off sharply. That's highly elastic demand. Understanding this difference is vital for a company setting prices. If your product is inelastic, you might be able to raise prices without losing too many customers. If it's elastic, a price hike could be disastrous. It also helps predict how competitors might react.
Okay, so that covers the basic mechanics of supply, demand, and how prices work in a, let's say, well-functioning market. But the real world isn't always so neat, is it?
Not at all. And this is where Dixit's analysis gets really interesting, focusing on situations where that beautiful market mechanism kind of breaks down or doesn't lead to the best social outcome. These are market failures.
Right. So moving from the ideal to the real, what are the big categories here?
Well, first you have things like imperfect competition monopolies, oligopolies where you don't have lots of competing firms. But the core failures are usually grouped into a few key types. The first major one is externalities.
Externalities.
Okay.
These are spillover effects, right?
Exactly. It's when a transaction between, say, a buyer and a seller imposes a cost or a benefit on a third party who wasn't directly involved in that deal.
And the classic example is pollution.
It's the textbook case of a negative externality. A factory produces goods and sells them, making a profit. The consumer buys the goods, but the pollution from the factory harms the local community, maybe through health problems or environmental damage. That cost, the harm, is external to the transaction. It's not reflected in the price of the goods.
So the market price is too low, effectively, because it doesn't account for the full social cost.
Precisely. And you can also have positive externalities, like when getting vaccinated protects not just you, but also the people around you.
Okay, what's another major market failure?
Public goods. These are tricky. They have two key characteristics. They're non-excludable, meaning you can't easily stop someone from using them, even if they don't pay.
Like streetlights or national defense.
Perfect examples. And they're also non-rivalrous, meaning one person using it doesn't reduce the amount available for others. My enjoyment of the streetlight doesn't dim it for you.
So what's the problem then?
The problem is the free rider problem. If people can benefit from the good without paying for it, they have an incentive not to pay. Why contribute to the streetlight fund if it'll be there anyway? This means private markets often underprovide public goods, which is why governments usually step in to provide them, funded through taxes.
Right, because otherwise nobody wants to pay for something everyone else can use for free.
Exactly. And the third big one, especially relevant today, is asymmetric information. This happens when one side of a transaction knows something important that the other side doesn't.
The famous market for lemons example comes to mind. Used cars.
That's the classic illustration from George Akerlof, which Dixit often uses. The seller of a used car knows whether it's a reliable peach or a problematic lemon, but the buyer typically doesn't.
So the buyer gets nervous.
Right. Buyers know they might get a lemon, so they're only willing to offer an average price, reflecting that risk. But if you have a really good car, a peach, you're not going to sell it for that low average price.
So the good cars leave the market.
Exactly. Only the lemons remain, or the market might just collapse entirely because buyers can't trust the quality. It shows how just an imbalance of information can wreck a market's efficiency.
That lemons example really drives home the point that we're often not just anonymous buyers and sellers. Our interactions are, well, strategic. We're trying to figure out what the other person knows or might do.
Absolutely. And this leads us directly into one of Dixit's core areas of expertise, strategic behavior and game theory.
Okay, so game theory isn't just for games like chess, right?
Not at all. Game theory is the formal study of any situation involving strategic interaction, meaning situations where the best outcome for you depends not just on your own choices, but crucially on the choices made by others as well. Think business competition, negotiations, political campaigns, even international relations.
It applies everywhere people's decisions affect each other.
Pretty much. And the most famous sort of introductory example is the prisoner's dilemma.
Right, the two suspects caught by the police.
Exactly. They're interrogated separately. If both stay silent, they both get a short sentence. If one confesses and implicates the other, who stays silent, the confessor goes free and the silent one gets a long sentence. If both confess, they both get a medium sentence.
And the dilemma is?
The dilemma is that from each individual prisoner's perspective, confessing is always the rational choice, regardless of what the other prisoner does. If the other stays silent, confessing gets you freedom instead of a short sentence. If the other confesses, confessing gets you a medium sentence instead of a long one.
So they both confess.
They both confess, acting in their own rational self-interest, and they both end up with a medium sentence, which is a worse outcome for both of them than if they had somehow managed to cooperate and stay silent.
So individual rationality leads to a collectively worse result.
Precisely. It illustrates things like destructive price wars, where two companies keep cutting prices to gain market share, ultimately hurting both their profits, or arms races between countries.
And this outcome, where both confess, even though it's bad, is stable somehow.
Yes. That's what's called a Nash equilibrium, named after John Nash. It's a state where no single player can improve their own outcome by unilaterally changing their strategy, given what the other players are doing. Since both prisoners are confessing, neither one is better off switching to silence on their own. It's a stable but often suboptimal trap. Dixit uses this powerfully to show the limits of purely individual rationality.
Wow. Okay. That's a lot to digest. So if we were to try and boil down the core messages from Dixit's approach, what are the main takeaways?
I think there are maybe three or four key themes that really stand out. First is the power of rational choice as an analytical foundation. Now, Dixit isn't saying people are always perfectly rational robots.
Well, how do you know they're not?
Of course. But the framework of rational choice, assuming people trick optimize given their goals and constraints, provides a really powerful, unified way to analyze behavior. It sets a baseline, a disciplined approach, and then we can study why people deviate from it.
So the reflection for you, the listener, is that adopting this kind of thinking even loosely, helps you be more consistent. It forces you to really weigh trade-offs. Think about opportunity costs, whether you're making investment decisions or just figuring out how to spend your weekend.
Exactly. The second big theme is the crucial role of strategic interactions. Dixit constantly reminds us that most important economic activity isn't anonymous. It's interdependent. You're not just acting in a market. You're often playing a game with competitors, colleagues, even family members.
So you need to anticipate their moves.
Anticipation is key. Thinking about how others will react to your choices is essential for success in almost any field.
Okay, what's next?
Third, the focus on information as a crucial economic resource. The market failure examples, especially asymmetric information, really hammer this home. Who knows what and when can dramatically affect outcomes. Information isn't just data, it's power. It has economic value.
And understanding that is obviously vital in today's, data-drenched digital economy.
Absolutely. And finally, there's his nuanced view on market efficiency and its limitations. Yes, markets can be incredibly effective at allocating resources under the right conditions, achieving that Pareto efficiency. But Dixit stresses that we must be aware of their inherent potential failures, externalities, public goods, information gaps, and so on.
So it's not blind faith in markets.
Not at all. Recognizing these limitations provides the theoretical basis for understanding when and how government intervention or other collective actions might be justified to improve social welfare.
Dixit's work, even in summary, seems packed with these really potent, memorable ideas. Are there any particular concepts or ways of phrasing things that stick with you?
Definitely. One that really captures the essence is something like, the fundamental problem of economics isn't really scarcity itself, but the need to make choices among alternatives when resources are limited.
I like that. It shifts the focus from just not having enough stuff to the active process, the mental burden of choosing, of making trade-offs. It makes economics feel much more universal.
Exactly. Another one, tapping into the game theory aspect, is the idea that strategic thinking in economics means recognizing your best choice depends on what others choose. And crucially, they're facing the same interdependence.
It really highlights that constant loop of anticipating reactions, knowing they're anticipating yours. It's dynamic.
It is. And maybe a third one, which sums up his balanced view on policy. Market efficiency isn't some natural state of affairs. It's an achievement that requires specific institutional conditions like property rights, contract enforcement, and needs continuous maintenance.
That's powerful. It implies that good markets don't just happen. They need to be built and supported by strong legal and regulatory frameworks. They're fragile in a way.
They are. It guards against complacency.
Okay, so we've got these powerful concepts. How can people listening apply this kind of thinking, like right away in their own lives or understanding the world?
Well, one immediate application is using marginal analysis to fight the sunk cost fallacy. This is a big one.
Ah, the trap of throwing good money after bad.
Exactly. Let's say you bought expensive, non-refundable tickets to a concert, and on the day you feel really sick. The money you spent on the tickets is a sunk cost. It's gone. You can't get it back. Dixit's logic says your decision now about whether to go should only depend on the future costs, like feeling miserable, and future benefits, enjoying the music maybe.
Yeah.
You ignore the money already spent.
It's hard to do, but rational. Cut your losses based on future prospects alone.
It is, and it applies to business projects, relationships, everything. Another personal one is just thinking about financial planning. Using intertemporal choice, consciously weighing the value of consuming something now versus saving and investing for potentially greater consumption later.
What about broader applications, like in business or policy?
Oh, tons. Businesses use price elasticity constantly, like we discussed, to figure out optimal pricing strategies. Should they lower the price to grab market share or raise it to increase revenue? Elasticity gives them the answer.
And they use game theory to anticipate competitors.
Absolutely. Thinking about whether a price cut will trigger a ruinous price war or how to react if a competitor launches a new product. It's all strategic gaming. And in policy, think about environmental issues.
Like the carbon tax example.
Exactly. When you hear about a carbon tax, you can immediately recognize it through Dixit's lens. It's a tool designed to correct the negative externality of pollution. It forces polluters to internalize the social cost of their emissions by making them pay for the damage. It's not just a tax. It's an attempt to align private costs with social costs to improve overall welfare.
That really clarifies the logic behind policies like that. So wrapping things up, what's the single most valuable lesson you take away from Dixit's approach to microeconomics?
For me, it's the idea that economic thinking, this structured way of analyzing choices and incentives, is genuinely an empowering skill. It demystifies a lot of the world. The key insight isn't just that markets are powerful, they are, but that we have to be incredibly aware of their limitations, their dependence on good institutions, and their specific failure modes.
The mathematical rigor isn't just for show, it's to provide precise guidance.
Exactly. It serves the goal of clear, reliable analysis for making better decisions, both personally and collectively.
What surprised me most, I think, was just how universal this toolkit feels. It's not just for economists or business leaders. The logic of opportunity cost, marginal analysis, strategic thinking, it applies to balancing work and life, evaluating political arguments, pretty much any situation involving scarce resources, which includes our time and attention.
It really does provide a fundamental lens.
So the final thought for you, our listener. Now that you have a better handle on this logic of incentives, scarcity, trade-offs, and strategic interaction, how does that change the way you look at the next policy debate you hear about, or the next big personal or financial decision you have to make?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Accotra Foundation.